This is the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
In range for Jensen. It is Jensen. What a brilliant stop by Foyt. Super save by Ian Foyt.
Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Me, Matt Beadle, here with this week's guest who's been to Belgium, Britain, Barcelona and back in one of goalkeeping's most varied of voyages. He's an actor, a music producer and a former Crazy Gang graduate with links to star-studded names in showbiz and beyond, now hammering home his quintessential goalkeeping goodness as part of the LA Galaxy backroom staff. Ian Foyt, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Wow, what an intro. I don't know, that's the best intro I've ever had. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for having me here in Los Angeles. We're at the Dignity Health Sports Park,
yes.
Correct?
There's been so many name changes, I can't remember them, but yes. For me, it's still the Home Depot Center, because that's when I first started at LA Galaxy. It's the Home Depot Center, but yeah, Dignity Health, we can call it that too.
So we're in a boardroom, right? Or a box, an executive box.
An executive box for the tennis court that they have, yeah.
So that's a tennis court down there.
Yeah.
It's quite the facility, we were saying beforehand. Yeah. So over the weekend, there was rugby going on here.
Yeah, they have the rugby sixes or sevens, whatever. I don't know. Yeah. They got the Gold Cup going on. They got Galaxy going on. Plus, our academy's going on. It's a pretty crazy place to be. And it's fun. It's always something going on. It's a great venue for sports.
And you've been here for quite a while, which we will get onto. We'll get into your story, your playing career. You were obviously in England for a period of time too. But first, we start the pod with some quickfire questions.
Sure.
Okay. The first of those is the gloves that you wore. What gloves did you wear?
Started with Roche. My first sponsor was Roche, and then I switched over to Adidas. Yeah.
Lovely. Favorite kit?
Favorite kit. My first West Ham kit was pretty special, but probably the one that sticks out the most was the first U.S. national team kit that I got. It's always special, your first, you know, and the Olympic one as well. But probably the USA.
Was that Adidas?
Yeah.
That kit?
Was Adidas. I was with the national team. The Olympics was Adidas, and then it went to Nike right after.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I kind of have a vision of the yellows and the reds. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
Nice. Great kit.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Great kit. Most memorable save that you've ever made?
Probably my penalty kick save for Luton against Watford, just because of the meaning of it. And it was at Watford in front of their big end, you know, their big stand. And I just went on loan there. I think it was only my second game. I had no idea of the hatred between these two teams. After I saved it, the ball went down the other end. It was like a corner kick. I just turned to the big stand behind me full of Watford supporters and gave it the old, I can't hear you anymore. And I've never seen so much stuff thrown at me. I had a Coke can, and I play with the crowd a little bit. So someone threw a Coke can, missed me, a full Coke can, and missed me by like 2 feet. Could have hurt. So I pick it up, I open it, and cheers the crowd. And, you know, half of them were like giving it a few signals with their hands, and half of them were kind of applauding, kind of respect, you know. It was a funny moment. So I cheers the crowd and took a sip, and yeah, it was, you know. But yeah, that was probably one of the most memorable. Yeah.
Luton protested in vain. The replay shows that Watford certainly seemed to have a case. But their delight was short-lived, thanks to Hatters keeper Ian Fewer. He stretched to his left to push Ramage's penalty onto the post, and Luton cleared the subsequent scramble.
Goalkeeping icon.
Schmeichel's up there. When I was a kid growing up in Vegas, the person I idolized, which is Tony Schumacher, which I know he's been known to be doing some crazy things against French people. But yeah, we had when I grew up in Vegas, just one game a week. It was called Soccer Made in Germany. We didn't get any other games. It was just that. And you'd get one game a week. I would record it on my VHS, and then I'd watch it continuously and just study the keepers. And he played for FC Köln back then. And it was always either Bayern Munich or FC Köln. They were kind of the two biggest teams. So I got a lot of exposure to Tony Schumacher, and he was playing for Germany, so he kind of became my idol. Just, he was a good keeper, but also just that was really the only game I saw per week. So him and probably, you know, Peter Schmeichel and a couple guys I played with, Ludo McClosco at West Ham, great goalkeeper, kept me out of the team. But yeah, probably those guys.
Okay, that was the final question, actually. The best goalkeeper you've either played with or against?
With Ludo, David Seaman. I had a short spell at Arsenal in 2003 for 4 months, and he was amazing, obviously, but just also a great guy, you know, just amazing guy. But Ludo was special. He was just – I remember we played at Leeds United. I'm sitting the bench, and he goes in for a challenge, gets cut on the eye – just gushing blood, goes in at halftime, gets, you know, 16 stitches over his eye, keeps playing, wins the game for us, plays amazing. And I'm just like, can you just, like, get hurt enough where I could, you know, not bad, chance. But just give me a chance, you know. But, yeah, he was quite amazing.
Okay. Well, like I said at the top there, your voyage in goalkeeping has been varied. You've got quite the story to tell just from that alone. You know, you were on trial at Arsenal, you've spent time with West Ham, you are entrenched now in goalkeeper coaching with LA Galaxy. So ordinarily when I interview a goalkeeper coach, I said to you before, we often start with the coaching side and then end on your playing career. But because your playing career is like a Hollywood movie, I thought we'd start there. Because, we've talked through a lot of stories on this podcast before, but I think this one, is quite special. I mean, we can't escape the fact that you are a giant, right? So you were at one time the tallest goalkeeper in the history of MLS, is that right?
I think I think so. There's been people that have surpassed that, but yes, at the time, I think it was the tallest in MLS, So maybe even in the Premier League, I'm not sure at the time.
So your height now?
6'7".
6'7", right. Yeah, I'd say you'd be up there. I can only think.
There was an Australian, I think he was 6'8 or 6'9".
Yeah. Pantilimon was a big fella, wasn't he? I think Sherpin at Brighton is quite a big lad as well. But that would be right up there. Mm. So I've kind of gone through your career, and I might quickly rattle through it just so we can summarize it. But if you could look back on your career now, how would you encapsulate everything that you experienced?
Just roller coaster ride. I played in teams that going into, if I would have studied them a little more, I might not have gone to, just because of the keepers. For example, Ludo McClusko, I wasn't getting him out of the team until he got injured or a red card, and it just never happened. You know, and it's no regrets. Obviously, it's one of my biggest achievements is playing for West Ham, and it's a dream come true. But, man, I wasn't getting in the team anytime quick at 23, 24 years old, and he was a, you know. So I had a lot of starting. I had a lot of sitting the bench, you know, trades, you know. So it was definitely a roller coaster ride for sure.
Okay, so I'm going to quickly go through this, right? So bear with me. This is a quick, just a quick skim of your career from what I've gleaned. So correct me if I've got any of this wrong. But you started at Club Bruges in 1988. That was on a one-year deal at under 16 level. You signed pro terms there. You were loaned to Molenbeek in 1991. So events kind of soured in Bruges to an extent, but you went to the 1992 Olympics in Barcelona with the US men's national team. You were eventually released from your contract and signed for Los Angeles Salsa, brilliant name, in 1993, named Rookie of the Year there. The following year, 1994-95, you signed for West Ham, as you mentioned, in the Premier League. You're loaned to Peterborough and Luton, who you eventually signed for in December 1995. You're named Player of the Year there. 3 years later, you return to the US. You're signed by MLS. You're allocated to New England Revolution. You're then loaned to Rushden and Diamonds during the off-season just to play in the conference. A year later, you're traded to Colorado Rapids. Another year later, so we're in the millennium now, January 2000, you sign a monthly deal with Cardiff. That's in League One. After the first month of that, however, you re-signed for West Ham until the end of the season, so back into the Premier League. You then signed for Wimbledon in the summer of that season. They'd just been relegated to the Championship. You're loaned to Derby the following campaign, back into the Premier League, released in the summer of 2002. You trial at Wickham, you trial at Leyton Orient. You eventually sign non-contract forms with Tranmere of League One. But 2 weeks later, as you mentioned at the top, you went on trial with Arsenal, back in the Premier League. You then signed non-contract forms with Wolves. They're in the Championship. That's the season they got promoted to the Premier League. And then you were close to signing for Crystal Palace a few weeks later. That didn't materialise. And subsequently, you retired in the autumn of 2002, 14 years of a career. So that's quite the story.
And a roller coaster for you.
Right? As you said.
Yeah. And a lot of those were short term, like the Wolves. That was, I signed for like, I think it was one game. And we couldn't come to an agreement. But yeah, the majority of the teams was West Ham, Luton, Molenbeek. I played a lot of games with as well. But yeah, it's a total roller coaster ride, man.
What I take from that is that you kept gravitating back to England. Was the goal to always play in England?
Yeah, my dream as a kid was to play in England. And then when I moved to the MLS, I was kind of, I've been there in Europe for so long. I was getting a little homesick. And the second I kind of got in the MLS, at the time the league wasn't as strong, and I didn't fancy it that much. It was something, and so I kind of made moves to get back to England right away, and then finish my career in England. So that's kind of what I did. But yeah, it was at the time the league is doing amazing now, but at the time it was just a little tough to plan.
The time at Belgium, you took a real leap of faith there, mm-hmm. right? Because you are a young lad growing up in Las Vegas, which mm-hmm. we'll get onto later on. But you're a young lad. You take a leap of faith and go and play in Belgium. That's mm-hmm. that's a big decision to make, to leave home.
Yeah. Going back to Tony Schumacher, so growing up, he was my idol. And I remember we had a magazine called Soccer America. And I opened it up, and it was like Tony Schumacher's doing a guest appearance for a goalkeeper camp in Alabama. And I was like, Mom, Dad, I got to go to this. I want to meet my idol. And previous year, my club team, we went to Belgium to just visit. And we stayed with host families and, you know, everything like that. And it was a great trip. So I really got the bug of going to Europe because, you know, that's where I wanted to play. But then I go to this camp in Alabama with Tony Schumacher. And after about 3-4 days, Tony Schumacher calls me up, sits me down. And I'm going, what's going on here, you know? He's like, hey, I've been watching you. He goes, you're pretty good. He goes, what do you want to do with football? I go, I want to become a pro and play in Europe. And he goes, okay. He goes, you need to go now. He goes, you got all the tools. You need to go now. And back then, the rule was if you signed before, I want to say 18, you were considered a homegrown player. Like you didn't need a visa. You didn't need it, you know. So here I am in Alabama. My role model tells me I'm good enough and I should go to Europe right away. And I already had plans in my mind to do it, just maybe not that soon. And I literally called my mom from Alabama and I just said, here's what just happened. I go, can we make this happen? My mom and dad, their wheels start, you know, getting engaged. And they're like, all right, let's see if we can get you to Belgium. Maybe you can stay with the family. The family that I stayed with was amazing. They housed me and fed me and everything and never charged a penny. So we sorted it out. I went over to Belgium at 16. And at that time, there was only one American that I've ever even got a trial or played for England, for Europe, is Paul Caligiuri. And I remember I was like, well, if he can do it, I mean, why can't I? And I went over to Belgium, stayed with the host family and knocked on a few doors. And I had a friend who lived in the village of maybe it was 60 people. He had a contact at two teams. One was a fourth division team that was local and one was FC Bruges. And he took me to the fourth division team that was local just to get a gauge and say, hey, is this guy, can he go off to FC Bruges and get a trial? So I went to this fourth division team and the guy goes, yeah, he's got a little something. You know, so the guy called his buddy at FC Bruges. I think he was like the reserve team coach. He looked at me on a rainy night, pouring rain, muddy, everything. And they looked at me for an hour. And after an hour, I went in the shower. I'm thinking like, okay, I think I did okay. They spoke with my buddy who was, you know, the connection. And they said that they want to give me just like a year. I'll be the 16 and under, third keeper of the 16 and unders. You're not going to play a single minute. They told me off the bat, and we'll just see where you're at the end of the year. Just worked my butt off, and the end of that season, I didn't play a single game. Yeah, you know, my parents even came over for Christmas during the Christmas break, and we had a scrimmage game I didn't even play in while they were there. So,
no, gosh,
oh yeah,
really?
Oh yeah, it was like it was cutthroat. I just wasn't as good as the other two. And I remember I just kept working my butt off in training, and then doing extra after training. I'd go against a wall for hours, kick against it, shoot against myself, everything. And then at the end of that season, there was a big tournament, a U23 tournament in France, and all the big teams there, Paris, you know, Bayern Munich, Rangers, I think we played against all these teams. And two or three keepers got injured, a couple were sick, and I just got a call like 2 days before. They're going, hey, you got to go and play. So I played every game. We lost every game, but got shelled on. But I was just making save after save after save. Long story short, I come back and the first team head coach calls me in. He goes, hey, great stuff. Love what I've been seeing. And they signed me from third keeper of the 16s. I went all the way up to third keeper of the first team.
Wow.
Signed pro at 17. So it just always staying ready, I guess, you know, came in handy.
And I'm guessing you had the belief. You said that you just weren't as good as the other two, but you must have felt at the time that you were better than the other two.
I just felt I can be or I will be, and nothing's going to stop me. And yeah, I felt at the time, secretly, I wouldn't have said it just because, you know, at that time, I was the first American goalkeeper in Europe. I had some major pushback. I mean, this is our sport. Go play basketball. Go play football. A few cuss words in there between. So I couldn't be just as good. I had to be way better because there was a lot of prejudice against Americans in that sport, you know. But I just kept my head down, kept going, and just tried to prove them wrong, you know.
I love the techniques you're saying. You'd shoot against yourself.
Mm-hmm. I would.
Yeah. So just whacking a ball against the wall and reacting to it.
I found there was a field right behind my host family, and there was a little it was kind of like the locker room, brick locker room, and there was some grass next to it, and I just started kicking against it, throwing against it, one-handed catches, two-handed catches, everything, you know, jumping rope, everything. Anything I could think of, you know. I'd have two balls. I'd kick it as far as I can for a goal kick, run down, kick them back, two ball, you know, just, you know, did more running than kicking, but, you know, anyway, kept you fit.
It's such a testament to, you've just said there, always being ready. Mm-hmm. That just shows, doesn't it? You've always got to be ready, even if you are miles off it, mm-hmm. in terms of the manager's perspective of you, the goalkeeper coach's perspective of you. Keep yourself ready because you never know what might be around the corner.
Yeah. And one coach might think you're miles off and the next one thinks, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You're the best thing. So when that coach sees you, you want to make sure you're showing what you can do.
We won't dwell on this too much, but I said that events soured there. Mm-hmm. What happened towards the end of your time at Club Brugge?
I got caught up. I don't know if you might be too young, but the Bosman ruling.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So yeah. I was at Brugge. I was third keeper. They sent me on loan. I got up to second keeper. Then they sent me on loan to get some games to Molenbeek. I played for Molenbeek, 35 games, I think it was. And then when Molenbeek wanted to buy me, Brugge said no. But then when I came back to Brugge, I was on the minimum contract. So they held my rights. They wouldn't let me go to the team that wanted to even pay money for. Okay. I was also out of contract. So before, even if you were out of contract, the club Brugge technically still owned my rights. Mm. So it's one thing they own my rights and they pay me a decent salary. They didn't. I was on the minimum wage. So that's where it got like real sour.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I see.
Yeah. So if you look up the Bosman ruling, that thing got changed pretty shortly after me because it was happening to a lot of players. Teams would just totally screw you over. So yeah, it was kind of, it was a weird,
right.
Not many people know about the Bosman ruling, but when you look it up, it was like, I got caught up with that.
BT yeah. Sports, now TNT Sports, actually did a really good documentary featuring John Bosman.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. And he's.
Because he was in Belgium too, right?
He was in Belgium. Yeah. Yeah.
We're doing a lot of that.
Yeah. And his life has gone a very different way since, but it's really interesting.
Okay,
so yeah, if you get an opportunity, do watch that. Yeah. I did read somewhere that you learned Dutch. Is that correct?
I still speak fluent Dutch. Yeah.
Fluent Dutch.
Yeah, well, I speak Brus, which is the dialect of Bruges. So what's
that's
funny
impressive.
Is I would start talking somewhere. And outside of Bruges. If I was in Bruges, people just thought I was from Bruges. But they're like, nah, he's a tall Belgian. But anyways, if I was outside Bruges, people would go, oh, you're from Bruges, right? And I'm like, no, I'm from Vegas. And they're like, what? Because it's not common that an American speaks fluent, you know, Flemish Dutch.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I spoke the dialect of Bruges, which was even funnier.
Can you give us any, just a little sentence?
Ik ben Ian Foyer, voetballer van Amerika, dat heb vijf jaar in België gespeeld.
Yeah. You've got a great accent. Yeah. Wow, right? You pull that off. Yeah.
So I just said I played 5 years in Belgium. Yeah.
To finish up on your career, one of the things I thought was interesting as well is that you'd been at West Ham, you'd been at Luton, you'd been at Peterborough. After you went to Colorado Rapids, you then came back to Rushden and Diamonds. But having been in the Premier League and in League One, I think it was, you then went into the conference or the National League as it is now. Was that just because you wanted to stay in people's minds to play football?
That was a great story. It was helping a buddy out.
Right.
So I'm back in England, and Terry Wesley, who was my coach at Luton, he became the assistant coach at Rushden. He heard I was in town, and he's like, "Hey, big man, what's up? I heard you're in town." He's like, "Hey, what's up, Terry? You know?" And he's like, "Hey, I'm at Rushden and Diamonds now. We have a keeper crisis. You want to play a game for us?" I was like, "Sure." Like, "Who are you playing?" He goes, "Playing Leeds United in the FA Cup tomorrow." Like, not tomorrow, but like 3 days from now.
Yeah.
And for me, I have no fear. So I was like, sure, why not? So non-league playing against, at the time, Leeds was in the Premier. And I was like, sure. So that was kind of like a one-off, you know. And then it turned into like three or four games because we had the replay, you know. So I played a couple league games in between. And it was fun. It was a great little club, great support. And we almost beat them. It was 0-0. That game, I was third day into the worst flu I ever had in my life. Yeah, I was literally puking up before and after and during the game. The cameras came out the day before, and I'm just been in bed, and I haven't got out of bed for like 3 days, and I just needed to get a little bit of a catch a ball at least. I shouldn't have played, put it that way. But Terry, there was no other keeper. They had no, you know, it's too late to sign anyone. And I remember I caught like 10 balls, just turning, just throwing up, whatever. And the cameraman filming me, he's just like, "Are you playing tomorrow?" Yeah, I was like, you know what I mean? Like, I was like, "Are you playing tomorrow?" I was a pasty white, just couldn't keep any food down. And long story short, I played a pretty good game, I feel. You know, I had a bunch of saves. And I remember the last kick of the game, I had to sprint outside the box, clear the ball with my feet. And as I'm running back, I'm like, I'm going to go down. Like, I'm passing out any second. Like, it was that bad. And I remember Lemsip got me through it. Like, I'd drink the double dose of Lemsip before the game, got me for the first, and it, like, I could feel it fade after about like 30 minutes. Halftime, a double dose of Lemsip, same thing, by 30 minutes. And by the last 15, I was just like, man, it was bad. But we almost scored in the last minute. Like, we had a header from like 2 yards out, and the guy headed it over, and would have been one of the biggest upsets, I think, in FA Cup history.
Hasselbeck. Granville, Wooding was a little leaden footed. Feinhardt's gone to the near post. Hopkin beyond, and Foyer tipped it over the bar. Another one with considerable swing on it. On by Woodgate to Feinhardt. Another good save by Ian Foyer. Rodwell lunged, couldn't make it. This is Kewell with Hopkin making a run. Still Harry Kewell. Good save by Foyer. Not for the first time this afternoon. Hasselbeck. Feinhardt. Oh, here's Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank, who's onside. Keeper is spread eagle. Kewell, keeper got a touch to it. Well, Ian Foyer is having one of those inspired FA Cup afternoons. And so far, he and his colleagues are thwarting Leeds United.
I'd love to know, because as you said, you grew up at a time, and football is very different here. Soccer is very different here now. I was watching a Little League game when I was over in Santa Barbara, and I got chatting to one of the coaches. Yeah. And instantly, as soon as he heard my accent, he was like, "Right, what? Who's your team? Who do you support?" Yeah, yeah. And he wanted to talk about football. He wanted to talk about the Premier League. And he said, you know, "We're all failed soccer players here." And I made the point of saying, "But this is you're playing the national sport." And he actually went, "Yeah," he said, "nah, used to be." The football's grown just immeasurably here. It's incredible. But at a time when you were growing up, what was the lure of goalkeeping in particular? Because as you said, you had basketball, you had baseball, you had American football, but you wanted to be a goalkeeper.
Another Hollywood story. Here we go. Have you seen the movie Casino?
Yes.
Okay, so it's based off of... It's a Hollywood version, not true. It's based off a true story, but it's Hollywood. So there's a lot of stuff that isn't, you know, legit. But it's based off a Chicago mob boss named Tony Spilotro. Famous guy, and they modeled the movie off him. And in real life, okay, the mob boss Tony Spilotro's sister's son is the guy that got me into football. So I'm in Vegas riding my BMX bike. And there's this other dude riding his BMX bike, and I'm, "Hey, what's up? What's your name?" His name's Anthony. "Oh, hi, I'm Ian." Long story short, you know, we become good friends. A few months later, he's like, hey, I'm playing on an AYSO soccer team. Do you want to play soccer? And I'm like, what, soccer? Sure, I'll play. I don't know. I'm like 7, 8 years old. So I start playing AYSO via Anthony Splatro, the mafia boss's daughter, sister's son, and start to really like it. I'm a left back, but I'm Bambi on ice. I'm just kind of tall and clumsy, you know. And I just grew a little more, and the coach goes, hey, just want to hop and goal? And the second I did, it was a kind of like, that was it, you know. So I loved it. I loved the physical contact. I played very aggressive. If you look back at some of the games I played very aggressive. So I love it if someone tries to kick me and, you know, I get up and just say, kick me harder kind of thing. So, yeah, it was just kind of from the start. Goalkeeping was in my blood, I guess, you know, and could have went to basketball, and I'd probably be too small now for basketball, but yeah, just grew an affection. And I think the other thing that made me really like football was, for example, baseball, we have the World Series. It drives me nuts. It drives me nuts. It's not the World Series. It's the American Series.
Yeah.
And so there's all these baseball players, and they're all like, most of them have like major egos, and they're all like, oh, soccer sucks, and, you know, all this. I'm like, no, it's the biggest sport in the world. No, it's not. It's World Series. And I'm like, dude, the World Series. You know, who is Cuba in it? I go, because Cuba will kick our ass. You know what I mean? Like, some of these Latin countries, they kick our ass in baseball. So, like, let's not invite them. Let's just call it the World Series, you know? I go, the true world thing is the World Cup, so just get it right. So there was that, a little bit of, like, rebelling against all those people that thought, you know, baseball and football and basketball were bigger than football. So, yeah, there was a little bit of that, you know, I wanted to prove to them, you know, what the biggest sport was.
Brought into goalkeeping by a gangster in some way.
He was a heavy dude. He was, if you look him up, Tony Spilatro, he was, he was a heavy dude. And I remember I'd be at my buddy's house. I'd like do a sleepover. I'd spend the night at his house and wake up the next day, and something must have happened where his sister, like the mob boss's sister, my buddy's mom, needed protection, and there'd be like some heavy dudes just sitting there, you know, literally cutting garlic with a razor blade, you know, like you see in the movies.
Yeah,
you know, like, how you doing, you know, hey, forget about it, like those type of guys, I guess, you know, needed like protection for a couple of days because maybe something was going down. Oh yeah. And I had no idea. I'm just like, hey, can you pass the Lucky Charms cereal? You know what I mean? And sitting between them, and I'm like, I had no clue.
Wow. Yeah. You had a very distinctive look as well, which I think is, we talk about that a lot on the podcast that I do with Rich, just about a goalkeeper's branding and the look. And I remember seeing you play when you were at Luton. Very distinctive. Of course, you're very tall, so that's instantly recognizable. But you had the long hair as well. And I think that, just, yeah, it made you more noticeable at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it, I had a mullet at a certain point. I had a mohawk at some time. I had a few different hairstyles, and then, yeah, I went short. But, yeah, I remember getting noticed a lot. I mean, I'd be at a restaurant or anywhere walking, and people, you know, if they were your fans, be, hey, Ian, how you doing? If it's the other ones, you Yankee, you know.
Right.
Which I loved.
Yeah.
I mean, the day I knew I made it in England was my first season playing in England. I ran out on the pitch and the whole, it would be an away game, and the fans would be like, who the are you, you know, that chant, right? I was like, okay, whatever, I'm a rookie, I'll take it. The following year it was Yankee, see you next Tuesday, and they were all singing it in unison, and I was just like, and I remember, like, I ran out and they're all Yankee, you know, and I kind of just went arms up, like, give me more, like, I can't hear, you know. And it was, you know, I was like, ah, I made it. They all know I'm a Yank.
That's right. It, yeah.
That's when I knew I made it. So, yeah.
That's the respect. That's what you show. Need. Yeah. I just want to quickly touch on some of the players that you would have played with, because you played for West Ham at a time where there were a number of characters. The fact you played for Wimbledon as well, so you were part of that whole... Yeah. The end of Wimbledon, as we knew that Wimbledon was nigh, I guess. Was there still a crazy gang culture? There was.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. If it was your birthday, you'd come out, your car would be on wood planks, your tires, wheels taken off. I remember... David Connolly came in with a brand new Prada jacket, 3/4 length, rabbit fur hoodie, everything, probably maybe 5, 6, 7 grand, right? 1,000 pounds. Comes in, and right away the boy's like, what is that? And he's like, oh, it's Prada. And, you know, long story short, we go to training, and all the players that were injured are kind of like, we come back in the locker room and all the players are kind of that are injured that usually go home early, they're kind of still sitting there, like kind of acting like they're busy. I'm like, something's up. So he's had this jacket for one day. He goes, showers, comes back, gets dressed, goes to put the jacket on. As he puts his jacket on, a sleeve pops off. So they cut it, but taped it on the inside so you couldn't see. So when he put it on, like the whole sleeve, so it became a vest. He was so pissed. And it was just, he had this thing for one day, probably $8,000-$9,000. And it just, like, just stuff like that. You couldn't for one, don't leave your food, come back. Someone's going to put something in it. Like, you just had to be on. It was like the movie, what are they called? Where they do all the pranks. I'm blanking.
Right. A Jackass.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, it was constant that.
Did you enjoy that as a
Yeah,
as
it was fun. Yeah. Like I said, you had to be on your, you know, on your guard, but it was fun. Yeah.
Les Seeley, did you encounter Les at West Ham?
He was my roommate.
Was he?
Yeah, he was my roommate at West Ham for a short spell. I was there when unfortunately he passed and went to the funeral and everything. And yeah, that was he was a character.
I have to say, I've heard conflicting reports on Les. One, that he's an absolute diamond of a bloke, and other people who found him really difficult. Yeah. There are actually some tapes that were found recently, I think in his loft, from maybe his son or someone else, a relative, because he was in the throes of chronicling his career to be an autobiography. Those tapes were never used, but a few have been released with him just talking on, you know, cassette tape. Okay. But yeah, I have heard conflicting reports about him.
He, if you don't know him, I could see how he could rub you the wrong way. Once you know him, oh my gosh, just absolute amazing human being. He was harsh. I mean, he would tell you exactly where you stood. He wouldn't hold back, and sometimes it hurt. You know, I could see that's where people maybe, you know, took it the wrong way, but he would at least you knew where you stood. He was great. For me, he was great.
Bieber, and now Boya, chance for another one, but an excellent save by Foyer.
We'll move on to your coaching career.
Yeah.
And we spoke a few months back just about you and your coaching career and your methods. And you mentioned the fact that you'd racked up 5 hours of coaching, you reckon, per day since 2004. Yeah. So that's 20 years. Yeah. So you've done a shift.
Yeah, I've one of the things that has made me, I guess, the keeper coach and the head, not head coach, but the coach that I am today, is having done the grassroots, where I'll have a group of 8 keepers at a club team. I'll have a 10 by 20 area. Half of them want to play goalkeeper, half of them don't. So now you're looking at how to inspire a kid that maybe doesn't want to do it, how to motivate a kid that's in a group with kids that don't want to do it, that does want to do it, how to motivate that kid. And then, you know, so all these different mental dynamics that I learned doing the grassroots just helped me when I hit the scene on the pro level, where to the point where the keepers are like, wow, this is the best training I've ever had. And I remember I came to Galaxy, and if I didn't have that grassroots coaching before, I would have come into Galaxy and maybe they would have liked it, but in no way would I have known what I've known and been able to design sessions the way I do. I design sessions sometimes strictly off the mental side. And then it turns into, it could be a shooting or a crossing session, but it starts with, okay, we got to get this keeper thinking about this situation during this scenario. How do we do, you know, it's interesting how much mental training I do within the sessions. It's crazy.
Just elaborate on that. How do you?
I call it speed of thought training, where I will create a game scenario. And sometimes there's sessions, depending on the day, where within one round that you do, there's going to be 5 game scenarios within one round. So it could be, you know, this into that shot, that into this cross shot, you know. So it's how, as I've learned that, yes, you have to be technically sound, so we do a lot of technical work, don't get me wrong, but a lot of the mistakes aren't technical. A lot of the mistakes are the speed of thought to go, if the ball goes from A to B, most keepers kind of go from A to B and they get set at B and they can make a save. It's when it goes from A to B to C to D to E to F to G, and at any point someone can shoot. And it could be you go A to B, you're set, someone shoots and it deflects and it starts spinning towards you. How quick do you realize, do I come out and attack the ball? Is my defender going to get there first? Is it better percentage to hold And that's what I work on. Makes sense? So it's creating as much randomness, as much game realism as you can, so that when it happens in a game, it's second nature. And I see it all the time where a keeper will get caught up in the moment. And I remember when I was coaching with the first team at Galaxy, we're at Seattle, big game. Anyways, our keeper, Jaime Pineda, played in World Cups, very experienced goalkeeper. And ball's getting played around the top of the box, goes to his left a little bit. He's at his near post, gets played wide. And instead of dropping centrally for the cross, he stays at his near post. Player out wide looks up and he sees Clint Dempsey at the far post. And he just goes, all I have to do is put any ball towards the middle of the goal, maybe 6 yards out. He won't get to it because he's at his near post. What do you know? Boom, header goal. And I'm looking at him going, that's not like Jaime, because he's a very experienced keeper. And I didn't tell him what I thought. I asked him, not even after the game, because it was too emotional. I asked him the next day, whatever, we went go over video. Jaime, what do you think, buddy? Because I want to hear his thoughts. I know what I want to tell him. And he kind of looks at it. Ball goes out wide, and he just goes, oh. It was the first time he saw it, too, because he was so emotional about it. In his broken English and my best Spanish, he goes, I should have dropped central. And I go, okay. I go, why didn't you? You know, he goes, there was so much happening here, and I was so focused on the A to B to C. When it went to D, I forgot to drop central. And that's when, like, I just went, okay, I'm going to start designing. It was that point on I started really designing things where it's just complete randomness. And the more randomness I can create, the more coaching points I get and go, okay, on that one, when that hit off the mannequin and it spun to the right, you need to go and attack that. You don't need to hold there. Because now percentage-wise attacking it, you're going to make a save 70% of the time. If you hold, you're going to make a save 30% of the time. You know what I mean? So that's kind of what I pride myself on in terms of my training style.
So creating that randomness, that chaos, I guess, is, I suppose in some ways, not only helping and developing the goalkeeper, but as a result, you're creating randomness for you to then build on as well, because you're seeing new scenarios that make you think about how to coach.
Yep. There's stuff that I'll start with this, and a play will happen where just some new random thing happens. I'm like, wow, I couldn't even try to create that if I wanted to. But then the next day I'll be like, okay, boom, created it. All right, let's work on it. And, you know, because everybody, you can stand in a position and a coach hits shots on you. Everybody's percentages at this level, at the pro level, is going to be pretty good. Then you go, okay, start central, come across, hit the shots on you. And then most of them will kind of stay the same. A couple, you'll see a few drop. Then you go, start central, come to here. I might shoot or I might pass it across to here. Then you see another little drop. And then you go, okay, start central, come across to here. I might shoot, might play it to this guy. This guy might lay it backwards to this guy for a volley. And then just every time you add another notch, you just see certain keepers either kind of staying about the same or dropping off. And those are the ones dropping off, obviously you want to help get better at. And then the ones that stay up there is the ones you kind of go like, oh, that's the guy I want starting for my team.
Mm.
You know, because again, I can hit shots on people. You won't see much difference between a lot of keepers. So it's interesting when you see it live happening. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You said before as well that an Ian Foyer goalkeeper, and you've been told this, right, is quintessentially an Ian Foyer goalkeeper there. Again, like you were back in your playing days, instantly recognizable.
Yeah. I have had a lot of, especially like with my academy keepers and that, like it's just a lot of either be a coach or a parent or, you know, some parent will come to me and like, do you coach this other keeper? And I'm like, yeah, how did you know? Oh yeah. We were at a tournament. We saw him playing and just knew it, you know, like they move around different, they're in positions, good positions. And, you know, I just, you know, it's for me, it's just making it hard to get scored on. That's if you score top corner, cool. But that's not where 90% of shots are going. You know, once in a while, someone belts one top corner, still save it. You know, and if you get in the good spots and, you know, have good technique and that, you'll probably save more than not. But it's for me, it's about just that real good fundamentals.
And rewinding back to when you were coaching kids at grassroots levels, mm-hmm. dealing with parents as well mm-hmm. is quite a key part of the job, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah. I mentored parents nonstop. You're in a world where you can't make a mistake, which you should be able to make us, you know, but you got to win, you know. So parents don't know how to react when a coach is yelling at their kid after a mistake or, you feel it. You're a parent. And, you know, your kid just let in a soft one at, you know, 0-0 the last 10 minutes. You lose 1-0 and, you know, the ball goes in the net. Everything stops. One side of the field's cheering. One side of the field's just like, ugh. So as a parent, you kind of feel this subconscious need to apologize. And some parents, the way they apologize indirectly to the other parents to say, oh, I saw it too, is to yell at their own kid, which is the last thing you want to do. Because if you take your best player on every team, and I'm going all the way up to the Premier League and the national teams and this, take your six, your ball hand, your just best player, and count every time they miss pass a ball, every time they don't defend properly, every time they don't go forward, every time they don't hit the target, and just put a little mark, they're going to have more mistakes than any keeper every game. The only difference is every time, imagine that six, same player, every time that he misses pass or she mispasses the ball, play stops, it's a goal, and it goes to the halfway line. I mean, imagine that. Mm, you know, that's pretty much what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're getting blamed, like just, I mean, the shot goes in and it's just like, I remember a keeper in the Premier League, ball went from, he's at his left near post, goes all the way to the right near post, he sets, and the guy belts one from 3 yards, top corner near post. And the commentator's, oh, I got beat near post. I'm like, he was 3 yards away, dude. And he went top corner. Like, what do you, we're not miracle, you know what I mean? Like, you know.
Does that exist out here as well, as much as it does back home? It does.
Yeah. Our I want to change the view of how this country views goalkeeping, because we are so critical. It's unbelievable. I have debates all the time with coaches. I told a coach one time, I go, and he kind of laughed in my face. I said, getting a back pass as a keeper is not technically, hear me out, mentally far more difficult than getting a pass as a 6 or an 8 or a 10. And he just laughed. And I go, well, you're 6, 8, or 10, you have a 360 degree. You can shield the ball. You can wait for support. You can change your mind. You can hold the ball. Like, you know what I mean? You can dribble. I go, we get a back pass, and between the back pass and where it reaches the keeper, in between, I mean, we most of the time we know beforehand anyways, but in between, beforehand, might have changed. You know, your left back's open, and all of a sudden you get the ball and left back's closed down. Now what? And now you can't shield the ball. Now you, so mentally, it's a very difficult situation to deal with.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think as coaches in this country, if you're going to be very critical of your keepers, especially at the younger ages, you might not have keepers at the older ages, because you're going to ruin them before, and you have to allow them for development. And again, another thing that I always say is, if a keeper peaks at a later stage, then you can't criticize a 15-year-old for being a 15-year-old, if that makes any sense. So if a keeper peaks at, let's say, 27, and a field player peaks at 24, and I don't mean peak by they're done, I just mean like they're getting good. Well, then a 15-year-old, are we going to evaluate him the same? Because it's no way, it's impossible to be 15 and also have the same mental capacity to be a goalkeeper as a field player, because the field player doesn't have the same mental pressures as a keeper does. So the patience has to be even more with your keeper, because I've seen keepers ruined by coaches and parents that I feel had tons of potential just because a soft goal goes in. So what? Have you seen the Premier League? I mean, every week you see soft goals going in. And it's like, if they can do it, why can't a 12-year-old do it?
That peak that you mentioned there, you used 27 as an example. Yeah. You know, goalkeepers, everyone says goalkeepers play longer, their career lasts longer. Do you think there is scope for that peak? So say a goalkeeper peaks at 27, 28, sometimes 30. Mm-hmm. Do you think there is scope for that to be reduced, to come down into their earlier?
That's the goal with the training that I'm doing. Because when I turned 27, around there, things started becoming easier. And what it was I saw everything a little quicker. I could see that ball deflected to this player and go, I need to come out here. Younger ages, it took me a little longer. So I'd be a half step late, guy slides it past you. And that's where, like I said, the training ties into what you just said, which is a great question. I'm trying to change that peak to like a 22, 23, if possible. I mean, it's hard, but it's game moments that make good goalkeepers. Can you feel the game? Can you recognize the pressure? Can you recognize what to do with the ball? How fast can you recognize, do I need to take even just one step forward to close the angle 1 yard? Or do I need to take one step back because it's a volley or it's some different type of shot? Or this player likes to do that. You know, that. So all those things have to be done. And before, in my mind, the only way I learned all those things was in games, trial and error. As a coach now, what I'm trying to do is force it on them. So it's not a longer, it's a shorter process to learn that. So you're getting more repetitions on those game scenarios that, let's say I used some of the stuff, I remember some of the sessions I designed is just stuff I used to hate. Oh man, when the guy got the ball at this angle and he's got a cutback cross, he's got a far post cross, he can shoot. I remember mentally, I was like, oh, what do I do? No, we practice it. And then we go, well, no, not on that one. That's what you got to do on this one. That's what you have to do. Oh, good job on that one. That's what you're looking for. And just body shapes, all different things. But if you just blast shots and make people jump over stuff, you can do that in the gym. And I see it all the time.
Within that speed of thought training then, and you said the word there, repetition, that's what's so key, right? Yep. Repetition, repetition, repetition.
Yep. And the difference is, like I said, I'll see a session and it's just, you know, keeper flying over rope 50 times. And that's repetition. But is it repetitions on something that's going to actually help you? And the way I equivalent it, because there's still a lot of head coaches that think that's good training. And I'm not knocking anybody that does it. It's different style. But what I can say is if you took a field player and made him sprint to a cone, touch it, come back, bicycle kick, run to the cone, another guy's crossing the ball, bicycle kick, and made him do 10 bicycle kicks in a row. That's the same equivalent of just diving top corner where you know where it's going to go. Run across, dive top corner, run across, dive to your left, run across, dive to your right. Keeper knows where it's going. In a game, you don't know where it's going. So the only thing you're really working on is physical. And yes, I get the mental component to it. You're making him tough or her tough. I think we're already tough at a certain level anyways. But how many times have you seen a keeper, you know, in the 70th minute, hands on knees, looking at the coach, sub, coach, I'm done. I'm too tired. It's not our role. I mean, if you're too tired after a 90-minute game, yeah, mentally you're tired, physically you have moments of tiredness. But if you can't handle a 90-minute game, I think there's something wrong. Then you can go to the gym and do some physical work. But it's not a physical position. You have to be physically fit, yes. You have to be mentally fit, yes. But it's not necessarily a position where you sit there and just go like, dude, I can't breathe here. Mm-hmm. I've had moments where I'm puffing because play got played around. So why are we working only on the physical? It's like I see it all the time. It's, oh, keep going, 50 times back and forth. I'm like, what are you working on? Like, what are you working on? That's not where your keeper made mistakes this weekend. Your keeper made a mistake by they ran across. They didn't set in time. They set after the shot. They kicked out. And the ball went 2 yards to his right. Well, if he was set and balanced, he makes the save. He catches the ball. And everything, that's the other thing. It's just everything's just like push away thing. I'm just like, start catching the ball again.
Oh, okay. Well, that's you know a topic, I mean? That comes up a lot, catching being a lost art.
Oh my God. Yeah. It's I see it. I'm like, you could have caught that. Think about what the next phase is. It's a corner kick. It's a rebound. And I get there's certain shots you can't catch, but damn, it's pretty easy. Because all the training is, it's this flashy, you know, YouTube kind of stuff where everybody's just like, you know, ball comes right out, smash it away because the next one's coming. Catch the damn ball when you can. That's what I was taught.
So you've played in England. Yeah. You've played out here. You're now coaching out here. You have been for a long time. Mm-hmm. Like I said, your actual title here at Galaxy is?
Director of goalkeeping.
Director of goalkeeping. So a pivotal part of the setup here. How different do you see goalkeeping now in the US and MLS compared to the Premier League and England? If there is a difference.
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of good goalkeepers. I feel there's some gaps in our goalkeeping now. And it goes back to similar stuff. You know, I feel, again, we don't catch a lot. I feel not a lot of keepers come for crosses. I feel we became very athletic. I mean, we've always been, in America, I'm talking specifically, we've always been athletic, but, you know, we're agile and, you know, great reactions. But in terms of really commanding every aspect of goalkeeping, I think, you know, we can probably do a little better. And I'm not talking every keeper. We have some great goalkeepers here, of course. But in general, the overall, you know, I think yeah, we could do a little better.
And you have been out here for a long time. Mm. Do you think there might potentially be the dream of return? I'm not saying it's a dream. I look outside here, bright blue skies. We're at this facility. Yeah. It's fantastic. Yeah. And, you know, I go home tonight and it's going to be freezing cold. Yeah. And it's going to be great.
Yeah. I know where you're going. Yeah. The answer is yes.
Okay.
Yes, good. I would like to venture out at some time. I'm very happy here at Galaxy. I want to fulfill everything I started here. But yeah, if you know, 10 years down the line or something, a team comes in and, you know, I'd love to branch out a little bit. You know, I do miss England. I miss the people more than anything, you know, the banter and the sense of humor and all that. But yeah, it was a good time there.
In his time at Luton, we became used to seeing this giant of a man make saves that other goalkeepers wouldn't physically have been able to.
So I'd like to venture into your early life and some of your adult life too. So we've got acting, we've got music, we've got Sinatra, Elvis, Paul Anka, Mickey Rourke, I believe is thrown in there, the Vegas gangster that you've spoken about, the film Predator. I mean, it's a minefield. What's
crazy.
Going on?
I know, it's crazy. So grew up in Vegas. My dad was a famous musician, famous in the music world, not famous by name. His name was famous in the music world, but I remember going as a kid to pick up my dad. My mom would, you know, throw me in the car. We'd go pick my dad. And all I remember is it was late at night for me because I was only like 4 or 5. And when this song, Suspicious Minds, sorry. So I'd be like laying down in the dressing room backstage, and I had no idea who Elvis was. And all I knew was is once he played that song, Suspicious Minds, that was his final song, and we'd be going home in like a half hour. And then it's like, oh, can this song finally come on? And now I'm like, damn, if I would have known, I would have I could have been in the audience watching. But I was only 4. Mom was a showgirl in Vegas, so they met through that. And then, Dad played for Elvis, Sinatra, Paul Anka, anything you can kind of think of from 1960 to like 1990, toured everything. So it was kind of a trip. Sister was married to Mickey Rourke for 10 years.
I mean, that's huge.
I know. Yeah. But during his heyday too, like nine and a half weeks.
Yeah.
And you know, so he was a big football fan too.
Was he?
Yeah. He loved football. Yeah. What else am I missing? Oh yeah. Me, movie career, played the Predator in Alien vs. Predator. Recently did, I don't know if you know this, I recently finished another movie called Werewolves.
Okay.
Going to be really good. Frank Grillo's the star. Lou Diamond Phillips is in it. It's about to be released in the theaters this month or next month. I play the werewolf. So, I actually did stunts on this one. Jumped off a 3-story building.
Off a 3-story building.
Yeah,
so you are, if you don't mind me asking, how old?
I am 52.
52. So you're jumping off 3-story buildings.
They couldn't believe it. I was like, yeah, I'll do it. You know? So look forward to that. It's called Werewolves. Just throwing a plug in there. But
I'm guessing I'm guessing the hype plays a part here.
Oh, yeah.
So that's why you're able to play these characters.
I remember for Predator, I was watching one of the goalkeepers that I trained at a soccer game, and this one guy named Mike comes up to me and he's like, hey, Mike, I just want to say great job with Jordan, the keeper, you know, because he was a father of a player on the same team. And, oh, thanks, Mike, you know. A year later, Mike calls me. He's like, hey, this is Ian, this is Mike. I was like, Mike, oh, yeah, we met at soccer. Oh, yeah, hey, Mike, how you doing? He's like, hey, how'd you like to play the Predator in the next movie? And I go, Mike, I go, no disrespect. I go, who are you and what do you do? Because, like, this is pretty random. He's like, yeah, I'm a producer. I think he was, like, somewhere. He was pretty big up in the movie business. Again, I have no fear. I just, sure, let's do it. So long story short, I did that. They loved how I did it. Just got right into the character, ran, you know, did all my things. And then the same company that did the suits for the Predator and all that, they did this next movie called Werewolf. And so they called me up for that, did that, and they loved it. So it's something that could maybe lead into other things, you know, because they really enjoyed how I did it. And there was a problem with the stunt guy one day. He was either sick or couldn't do it. The guy comes up and he goes, hey, you want to do it? And I was like, sure. So I'm like, I did a couple things. I'm riding on top of a car, you know, down the street, they're swerving, trying to get me off the car. And, you know, it was fun. It was fun.
So are you in massive suit? It's not prosthetics. You're in a big giant suit.
Yeah. So it's basically like putting a massive wetsuit on, massive boots, gloves, and then this, you know, there's two different helmets. One is 30 pounds and the other one's about 50 pounds. And the 50 pound one has just every part of the face moves. So the mouth, the teeth, the eyes, the ears, the eyebrows, like it's so realistic looking. And that thing weighs a lot. And you have that on for about 10 minutes. Your neck is starting to, you know, and I'd had it on for hours at a time sometimes. So it does take someone that's very, you mentally have to get into this role because it is claustrophobic. You can't breathe that often. You know, you can barely see through the mask. But again, for me, it was kind of like how I played. Like I almost enjoyed pain a little bit. Like if you kicked me, you know, it would hurt, but I'd just get up and, you know, so it was, yeah, another adventure that I think a lot of people would overthink and say no, like, oh, I don't know, how can I do that? I just, yeah, sure, let's do it. You know, so yeah, it's kind of crazy.
I mean, I those types of films, yeah, like I just can't watch those films. I don't know what it is. It's just something about me. I just can't watch them. But now I know that you yeah, are inside the costume. Maybe I can watch it. That will help.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Well, this, I'm telling you, the werewolf one is, I haven't seen it yet because it's under wraps, you know, and I was doing it, so I couldn't see it, obviously. But from the producer, they're saying this is a really good movie.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty scary.
Werewolves.
Yeah, we'll right, see it. It's going to be promoted soon. Universal Studios picked it up, so.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. And music. So you said before we came on air that because we were getting the sound equipment out that you know your way around this sort of stuff.
Well, music is in my blood, obviously, because of my dad. So I just, when I was young, my best buddy, he was a DJ for like house parties. Not house music, but just parties at a house, you know, because house music wasn't really, it was just starting then. So I kind of picked it up a little bit, and then all of a sudden I just really picked it up like about 5 years ago again. So I kind of, I guess, pride myself. I can get on the turntables a little bit. I've done a few parties now, a couple 50th birthday parties, and it was fun. Yeah. People, I love the energy when you play a song and everybody starts to like kind of vibe to it. It's similar to like making a save and the adrenaline rush of doing something that makes people happy. You know, which is why, going off to another thing, why I like to cook as well.
Okay.
Right. I know.
to a good standard cooking?
I've been told. Yeah. I mean, not me saying it, but yeah, I've been told I can cook pretty good. Yeah. And so again, it's something I cook and I feed people and that makes them smile and that makes me in return very happy. So it's an adrenaline rush again.
Yeah. So brings it all back to goalkeeping, doesn't it?
It brings it all back to goalkeeping.
There you go. Yeah. Where can people find your music?
Just Ian Foyer Music on Spotify and then SoundCloud.
Okay.
Yeah, just if you go to my, if you go to Instagram, Ian Foyer Music, and then there's also Ian Foyer Movies. And then I also have just Ian Foyer. So I have three Instagrams. The movies one isn't hyped up as much now because I can't release anything from the werewolf movie until it's released. Because I've had people even calling me like, hey, I'll give you X amount of dollars if you show us a picture of what it looks like. Because everybody's trying to figure out what it looks like. But yeah, Ian Foyer is for the soccer, Ian Foyer Music, and then Ian Foyer Movies. So.
Branding. There you go.
Right.
That's it. The Ian Foyer brand, the franchise, I should say, of Ian Foyer. Okay. Well, we have a theme tune for the Goalkeepers Union podcast, but perhaps for this pod, we'll end with some Ian Foyer music. I think that might work.
Okay.
But before we get to that and Richard Lee's final question, which he always likes to ask, a little quiz for you, Ian, on you and your career. Okay. So the quiz is called Ian Foyer. How well do you know you?
Oh, God.
So just some questions on you, you know, no pressure.
Oof.
All right. You're not competing against anyone, but cue the music. Your international debut came on 18th of March, 1992. Who was it against and what was the score?
Morocco, I think. I think we lost 1-0.
It was 3-1.
3-1.
I believe.
I know I got scored on. That's why I'm thinking it's 1-0.
Ah, okay.
I got scored
on. You came on for Mark Dodd in the second half.
Yeah.
What was the occupation of LA Salsa owner William De La Peña?
Ophthalmologist.
Correct. Very good. He sounded like a character.
Oh, he was.
You played the Predator, as we've discussed. Bone Grill in Aliens vs. Predator, Requiem. What were the names of the other two Predators in the film?
Man. I don't even know.
One is close to the film that you've just made.
Oh, Wolf. Wolf Predator. Okay.
And Bull.
I knew there were different names. I just was so in the moment. I was sweating.
In what year were you named Rookie Goalkeeper of the Season?
Salsa, that would have been 93.
Okay. Bang on. What was the fee paid for your services by Luton Town when signing you from West Ham?
There's some discrepancies on this because I had I think my agent did a little sneaky one on me. It said 580, but I think it was more towards 680 or 7.
Really?
Yeah.
Those dastardly agents.
I know.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Who was in the opposition net, I love this, when you made your Luton debut at Millwall in September 1995?
Casey Keller.
Brilliant.
Isn't that crazy?
That's just
unbelievable. It was crazy. And the Luton thing happened so quick. I think we played on a Tuesday night at Millwall, and I knew on Monday. So I didn't have time to call Casey or whatever. I just walked out on the pitch, and I just, thumbs up from across. He's like...
Did he know you knew each other?
Yeah. We knew each other because with the national team, we already played together. So that was crazy. Yeah, forgot about that. Yeah.
That's a great memory to have, isn't
it?
It's
amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. And, Casey was amazing keeper as well, so.
That might be another question coming up for you. What number did you wear in your second spell with West Ham? Your second spell.
That would have been 18?
Number 29.
Oh, yeah, damn it. 18 was the Olympics. Yeah, okay, 29. I still have the shirt on my... Should know. Well, it's facing the other way, so...
Right. You were on the bench for the first game of the 1992 Olympics, so this was the first game of the actual tournament between USA and Italy. Mm-hmm. What was significant about that game?
What was significant?
We've actually spoken a bit about it. You brought it up in conversation earlier. The fact that it was 1992 and then
the dream team?
No.
Oh, about our game, our game specifically.
Your game specifically was the first game.
Yeah.
To it feature opened. Yep. Uh-huh. Something.
Oh. Uh-huh. Stumped.
The back pass. The back pass rule. It was the first competitive game.
Oh, yes.
To feature
it was.
The back pass rule.
You know what? I knew that, but I totally forgot about that. That's crazy.
What was that like? What was that?
Was it crazy.
Because it was Brad Friedel, I'm guessing, in goal?
Yeah.
So that must have been.
Talk about just changing everything. You get a back pass and just pick it up.
Mm.
And now you can't. And it's best rule ever.
Yeah,
obviously.
It's a brilliant rule change.
It's the shot clock in basketball. But we had to overnight learn how to play with our feet. We would never get involved with our feet before, and all of a sudden overnight you just have to change your whole style of play. It's crazy. Wow, I totally forgot about that.
Bit of history you were involved in there.
That is the first game.
Yeah.
Wow.
You are one, as you mentioned there, of 9 US goalkeepers to have played in England's top flight. Can you name the other 8?
Oh, man. Tim Howard, Casey, Keller, Friedel, Hoteman, Jürgen Sommer?
3 more. One is currently playing.
Yeah, no. Matt Turner. Jesus. Sorry, Matt. 2 more, right?
Yeah, 2 more. One has recently returned to MLS.
Went to Colorado.
He did.
First letter.
Z.
Yeah, Zach. Jesus, why am I blanking so much? It's the pressure.
And then one more. Played for Aston Villa and Middlesbrough, I think.
Gazan. Brad Gazan.
That's it. Yes. Got there eventually.
That was pressure. Sorry, guys.
And the final question of the quiz. Tom Jones's highest charting single in the US was written by Paul Anka. What was the song? And if you're not a man.
Oh, Scott. Oh, wait. Oh, man.
I'll give it to you, shall I?
Yeah.
She's a Lady.
Oh, God. Ian, be better. Oh, such a good song, too.
Great song. Yeah.
Wow.
I guess you knew Paul Anka quite well, right?
Yeah. I used to hang out at his house.
Amazing.
I remember, so Elvis gave his band this signature cologne in the shape of a guitar. And I remember around 8 or 9, it was just sitting on the shelf somewhere, and I got into cologne. You know, I thought cologne was the way to get girls, you know, like if you smelled good. So you just douse it. I had Aqua Velva, this, you know, mm-hmm. the cheap stuff. I was like, so what's that? And I looked, and it was just cologne. I was like, oh. I started using it just a little bit. Finally used the whole bottle up. And then my dad just calls me, like, he goes, who used this? And it was his Elvis, like, souvenir. And I was just, I was grounded for, like, about a couple of weeks. But, yeah. I smelled good, at least.
And I said to finish, we end on Richard Lee's final question. Sure. So Richard likes to ask this. Richard, take it away.
Yes, we've got to the most important part of the show, in my biased opinion. And now my Watford friends aren't going to like me saying this, but great guy, great goalkeeper. Ian Foyer, what has goalkeeping given you?
Wow, everything. God, took me, got my kids, championships, life lessons. What hasn't it given me? Gosh, really everything. I'm so grateful. I always say I'm the luckiest man on the planet to... you know, I've never really had a job. I signed pro at 17, achieved my dreams, played in a couple movies, can cook my own food. Went to 3 MLS Cup finals with Galaxy. I'm currently at Galaxy building what I feel, you know, is one of the best goalkeeper programs in the country. I have amazing staff from Greg at the first team to staff, Matt, who's the coach, the second team, all the way down to Jonathan Lamelli, who's basically my soccer wife. He's my staff for the academy and helps me every day. I don't know what I'd do without him either. So it's brought me a lot of good friendships and just memorable moments, some of the laughs, you know, the spell at West Ham with, you know, Ian Bishop, John Moncur, those guys are just hilarious. Just stories after stories. So couldn't think of anything better. Yeah.
Ian Foyer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Good job, he is 6'7".